Welcome to the podcast of the University Community Dialogue on Culture and Children's Mental Health, brought to you by the Cultural Providers Network, or CPN, and the Center for Excellence in Children's Mental Health. The purpose of this dialogue is to encourage collaboration and understanding of the work of the CPN and University of Minnesota faculty and staff with an interest in researching children's mental health. Vivian Jenkins Nelson facilitated the following discussion, which is structured as a fishbowl. The fishbowl method of discussion let the CPN answer questions and explain their work first, while the university members listened and occasionally asked questions. Later, the university members answer questions and explain their work, while the CPN members listen and ask questions. You will now hear Vivian asking the CPN members the first question.
I have a set group of questions, so like I told you, that I have a lot of this for people. So I'm going to throw them out. If you have a question for the group, put your hand up, and then we'll toss it in, and hopefully everybody will be able to. Can you hear better now? I sure can. Yeah. That was a great idea, Matthew. All right. Okay. Let's do this real quickly. First name, run around. Okay, can you back up just a wee bit? Okay.
Renita Wilson.
Tanya. Bill.
Rakita. Yua.
Matthew.
Joel.
Karen.
Roberto.
David.
Suzanne.
Deb.
Meryl.
Emily.
Richard.
Raquel. Pete.
And Vivian. Okay. Now, here's the first question for this group. How do you come to know when certain practices or interventions or therapies are successful?
It's a big question.
How do you know? Now, understand, we're not looking for right answers here. This is just what you know. Scooch back this one up a little bit. There we go. Okay. So, how do you come to know when certain practices, interventions, therapies are successful?
An interesting question, because we have spent days and days and days on this. We've probably spent about 7 or 8 sessions discussing it, and so it's a difficult question. The part I'm going to say, just to get things going, is just from a purely pragmatic, measurable piece, if it meets the criteria by which the funding source says that you are now providing a service. Get that piece out there, because that is definitely one of the first. It's a measurable piece that says, yes, it's been determined to be successful by me and by somebody else.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Other folks, go.
Before that process of somebody dictating, I'll pay you for a service, long time the Latino community has always had in-home services, mental health services, because we knew there were some barriers, some obstacles, transportation, child care, whatever. And we initiated all of that stuff before the managed care came in. Unfortunately, the system has put more criteria, more rules that prevents people from doing that.
It's very interesting. I didn't know that. Matthew?
As a person that works with folks that are in therapy, I get to see the results. And those that I think have been successful are the ones that are feeling good about themselves. You know, so it's very subjective to the person. And which means that me, as an advocate, don't let me know who their therapist is and they're not doing well, they don't feel well, because it's like, what the heck are you doing with this person? So anyway, that's just real subjective.
Okay. Don't hold up your hand, just start talking. Get in there.
Just to build on what Matthias said, when things work for the people that came to us, that's when I know it's right. Been effective.
Okay, I see a lot of nodding with that. How things work.
I was thinking the same thing. I was thinking of the words golden moments. And Suzanne and I had golden moments the other day. A mother, who is one of our parent catalysts and is Somali, asked us to come with her to her child's. It was the pre-IP where they're deciding to do assessment. And there was also a mentor pacer there who was Somali, and he is an advocate. And we listened mostly. She was, the mother was so articulate. But the fact that there was this group of people who were on her side, and not in a combative way, in a respectful way, I felt that it gave strength, and it taught the teachers who were, they were all, you know, middle-class white type teachers. Yeah. It taught them a lot about her, that she was very articulate, she was very educated, and she broke their stereotypes of what they might have thought she was going to be when she came in that room. So she didn't just sign on the dotted line.
I used to work for nonprofit organizations, and even though not a clinical person, it was clear to me that when one of our program participants came to me or to someone and expressed how much they had changed or how well their child was doing, because we provided chemical help as well as children's mental health. So to me, the testimonial, the fact that I could see change and that the person themselves could say, I really like that person and they have helped me so much.
One of the things that, you know, Meryl said, we've had this discussion a number of times, and one of the things I think we struggled with is that we all believe that our cultures and our cultural background mean that different people from different cultures define success differently, but we haven't been able to articulate that very well, and usually when we articulate what success is, we're talking about, well, does the client feel like they're successful, but it's we have this really strong belief, I think, that culture is an important part in how you define success, but we've not been able to articulate well really more. How do we explain that to other people? How do we flesh that out? And I think that's something that we're hoping to continue to work on.
I work more in the community. I work directly with parents. I advocate. And for me, what is a measure that something is successful, I hear about it. The networking that parents do, you know, oh, if you're looking for this kind of doctor, go to so-and-so. And the word of mouth really, you know, and then if there's something really negative, you hear about that as well. So the two extremes. So that's my measure that things must be going right there, the feedback.
I miss all my people based on what it validates to me. A lot of time, they have to tell me that. And I don't have to look at any book or inside any research to say, this must be working. They have to be the one that validates themselves, not any researcher.
And I think you can get an early indication of that too, before you've got measurable results, before you've got the change in the target behaviors or whatever, by just listening if the approach you're going to try resonates with them. I mean, if it's something that you can just tell, or that they specifically say, you know what, this doesn't work, this isn't going to do it for us, then it might be time to look for something else. But if that's something that when they hear it, they grab onto it and like, yes, that fits with us, that's a good indication that you're going to have a better chance at success.
I think success is an interesting term, because sometimes other people tell you have a problem and you don't have a problem. And so what are we fixing? And so I'm working in a multicultural factor right now, and I'm learning so much because several of the cultures, I'm working in the chemical addiction area, what's happening, they may be in trouble, or other people may be saying you've got a problem, and they don't have a problem. So what am I working on, and you know, what is successful? And I think it goes down to that core of, you know, the initial focus. What are we trying to fix? And is it a problem?
And who is it a problem for?
For.
Yeah.
You know, this is my time to tell my story. But when I was a case manager, we were working with folks that actually were living in women that were living in transitional housing. And this one woman had dissociative identity disorder. And she was actually in going in a crisis. And she saw herself as a child in this box. That and I had to work with her because it was at night. And so she was in this box, and there were bugs that were biting her, you know. And so I'm trying to work with her to try to get her out of the box. And, you know, because...
Is this a literal box or a figurative
it,
box?
It's in... Yeah, she was dissociating.
Okay.
And so I'm really trying to work with her so she can get out of this box so she can feel better, you know. And nothing is working, and she's actually getting worse, getting farther into it, and I'm just kind of freaking. And finally, I was frustrated. And I said, so what can I do to help you? She said, I need a light. And she was scared of the dark. The bugs were not bothering her. It was the light she needed. So when, and you know, it's kind of like, you know, when she got the light, it was okay. And then she kind of did want to get out of the box because it was actually uncomfortable. And it still had nothing to do with the bugs. That would be freaking me out. But the point is, how many times, actually I had to write this down, how many times do we put our values on other folks? And one of the things that I heard that made me think of that was, you know, this person was really articulate. Well, most of the folks that I try to get to have never been given voice to anything that's going on with them. And so for me, as far as what I see as success, is being able to work in a collaborative relationship that they get their needs met. And if I learn from them, they get their needs met. Because like you said, sometimes things are not a problem for folks. For instance, being homeless would be a very big problem for me. Many folks, it's not a problem for. It's a bigger problem to live in housing because there's too many restrictions for whatever illnesses they have. So for me, for success is, how can I work with the person so that they feel comfortable, that they feel that their goals are being met? Because their goals are not the same as mine, you know? And that's, and I guess I'm getting more passionate about that because I see, you know, it's like, by whose standards are you judged? And it was like Alberto was talking about funding. All of us know the trip of, well, these are the guidelines, and you've got to do this, and if you don't do this, then you can, you know, those outcomes are not going to be right. And has nothing to do with the people that we're working with that need our assistance. So I could go on.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, clinical success, when we look at that, is probably looking at outside the box too, because, you know, I talk about when you're telling a story, I'm going to tell a story too, about, you know, we started this program called Lujong Targeting Hmong Girls. And if you think about it, you know, most of them present in schools as quiet, you know, does well in school, you know, is very helpful, but they're not very expressive. And we realize that when we are successful with them, they're more talkative in class, they share more. And, you know, we may think, well, how does that help? But, you know, for them to be able to express themselves and, you know, to feel comfortable, you know, and that instead of isolating themselves, internalizing everything. And, you know, we spend a lot more time focusing on the kids who are, like, you know, hitting each other and doing all that, and then we mm-hmm. forget about, you know, the quiet ones who mm-hmm. are just, you know, yeah, introverting everything.
Any questions from out here? Any questions you want to throw in this group?
May I?
Okay.
So you all obviously represent disciplines like social work, family therapy, you name a few, public health, counseling, that believe that they have trained you to work in a way that is helpful if you don't use the word success. Is that different from what you experience in reality? You know what I mean?
Yes.
What's your
training
point? What's your
experience?
Okay, go.
Well, unfortunately, because my experience in Laredo, Texas, which is bilingual, see, it's right on the border. And I learned real quick, you do a yes thing, do your homework, you pacify the teachers, right? Mm-hmm. Because when I moved from Chicago, from Laredo to East Chicago, Indiana, I was put back because Texas schools were not as good as the Midwest schools. And my name was not Avina, it was Avina. Not Roberto, Robert. That really sealed the thing. So every education that I've got in the United States, I did it by checking with friends and people that I connected and took what was best, which we're saying, people will take what you give them that works for them. And when I was going to school, whether it was social work or whatever, people were trying to tell me what I should see versus what I should be paying attention to, which a long time ago I learned from very elder people. You watch the whole world and look at everything. And that becomes very important. Because somebody that wants to dictate that I'm no longer Avinia, which is my name, and Roberto, which is my first name, that's a problem. And we keep dictating that stuff. You gotta have this grade, or you gotta do these things, or you gotta do that other thing. It's changing people's worlds. And that, I hear it all the time, not only with the young kids, I hear it from people who are immigrants, who are striving, and that's why we have a whole bunch of them suffering right now, because they're jumping up somewhere.
You know, part of the question is, does the academy prepare practitioners to meet the needs of families that we see out here? I think the answer is yes and no.
Yeah.
I felt real lucky that some of my mentors, some of whom are in this room, people who I met early in my grad school career, told me, you will not learn everything that you need to learn to be successful, particularly working cross-culturally in this place. And so I knew that there were some things that they could teach me and that the academy could teach me, but there were other things that I was going to learn out in the field. So I think the answer for me is yes and no.
And you mentioned mentor, and you had to select somebody you trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I can say that. They were mentors in my path.
Very important.
Yep. Well, thank you. This is wonderful. Great question. All right, leap in there.
To me, it's a question, I think it's a yes or no, and it's more of a question of when it kicks in. First of all, my formal training was probably about 35 or 40 years ago, so I'm not going to apply that. I'll apply more updated things that I have. I think where the training tends not to do is to get started the definition of success and take you to where you can use the skills. I go back to the definition of success. To me, that's what success pretty much is. I can develop a definition with success, of success with, I'll use the word client here, develop that definition of success the closer I can relate to that person culturally, age-wise, gender-wise, whatever. The farther apart we are, the harder it is to come up with a definition that's based on an understanding and trust. And so that's not something, I think we talk about therapeutic alliance more in the current standard, but I think that developing that definition of success goes quite a bit beyond that. The ability to do that creates then, if you're going to be able to achieve that success, and it's a moving, should be a moving definition of success, and it's able to move based on, once again, how we develop the definition of success, because it could be different a month from now, but if we haven't got the trust, we don't know it. I think where the training comes in then is once that definition is defined, do I have the skills to do it based on my training? Because the rest is more of an understanding and awareness and preparation. Where the training comes in now, I think, is I know when I don't have the skills, I can use other resources and refer that person out. That's where it kicks in now. I think it kicks in too early, typically, and that other part gets missed a little bit.
Thank you.
I spent about 5 years in the children's mental health division, and the population that I was working with were the population of children under the age of 5. In which for a long time we didn't believe that kids 2 or 3 years old would be impacted by what is happening around them or to their families. And one of the things that I really value that I wish we can take, and it seems to me the conversation, the use of therapeutic alliance, and how do you build that respect in the family? If you ask a family in a screening tool, does your child cry all night? And you ask the next question, is that a problem for you? And if mom or dad say no, that the therapist is instructed to leave that alone, don't pathologize that. Because if the family cultural norms of child rearing or the family cultural norms of how a child at a certain age should behave does not necessarily always fit with the Western institutions that we are mostly educated under, because it adheres to another group of people that may not be the population, especially the populations of color that we are working with. So how do you build then a genuine strategic alliance so the parent feels that my response or my concern are valued and taken to the same level as what the book or the theory teaches me? And I think that we cannot learn in the institution because they are not designed for that. We are not quite there yet.
Can I leap in here? this point. One of the things that I learned here at the university is that small children don't grieve.
Oh, yes.
I knew different than that. I also learned here that adolescents who are African American are way more sexy than white kids. That was in my adolescent sex course. And of course, more deviant in that way. I learned also a lot of good things. But what I also learned was that I did not have enough of a critical mass to check any of that out with. Because it turned out, when I went to complain to the dean, he said, well, you're the only black person in the division. How does that work? You know, how do you learn from your community? We need to have community within the academy. So we work very hard to build a student base, that students aren't just relying on us for learning, that they have a critical mass of other people of color. They can check some of this out with them. You know, because we can drive people crazy. I thought I was insane several times. I always was like, of course. But anyway, back to you.
I can maybe build on something that Antonia was saying. And I recall early in my formal training, I was rigorously trying to build a toolkit that I would apply to clients that I would serve cross-culturally or otherwise. I was fortunate to have a mentor who helped me understand something that was fundamental to my development, and that was therapy is really the blend of art and science. So I think in the academy, we get a lot of the science, and rightfully so. What we do should be grounded in something that's verifiable. Otherwise, we're just throwing darts at a wall. That's not responsible practice. But so much of what we learn that's valuable comes through doing and learning, and often learning from clients. And I think Western culture often tells us that we have to do something, right? Someone comes in the door and you have to fix it. And a lot of us have a natural inclination to fix anyway. That's one of the things that probably brings us into the field. But I know Dr. Goh talks about this, a tolerance for ambiguity, that sometimes you're not going to have the answer, and you have to learn to be able to follow the client's lead and to go with the flow and to be open to learning. I think sometimes we leave the academy with a lot of rigidity. We learn over time through practice that we have to be more fluid and flexible and say that we try to be.
Actually, if we can do that, I think we can help the folks that come to us, because they're going to have their lives in front of them a lot longer than we're going to have them in front of us. And if we can teach them to deal with that kind of ambiguity and that kind of partialness about life, we're going to be teaching them something that's going to allow them to feed themselves.
This leads us right to the next question that I wanted to throw out here, and that is, how would you like to use research or evidence in your work?
That's a great question for me. I'm overseeing 7 population-specific grants right now for DHS, so I'm unfortunately in this discussion a funder with expectations that we put out in an RFP that we're holding people accountable to, and they won't get funding unless they achieve some of their outcomes, both short and long term. And it's been fascinating to look at this, but what we asked in this RFP is we left it open-ended so that these communities, and specifically African-American, Southeast Asian, American Indian, Hispanic, Latino, and a general population were to come to us and tell us in recovery, for supporting people to sustain sobriety and stability, what are the natural healing processes that we could learn from and how are those being implemented, and we would like to fund that. Because there's no funding right now out of insurance or medical assistance, and there's no research that tells us an evidence-based practice. What help us? You teach us, because we'd like to work that up to an evidence-based model. And we've been working with Bill and others about this, which has been fascinating in this group discussion about community-based evidence and how do we hold that up. And of course, my goal is to continue the funding for these programs and to shine light on them and to help them work towards some kind of sustainability. Right now, there is no research in any capacity for any of this. And my hope in joining this group was to try to make some links about that, to see how, who could help us. Because we can't interpret what's happening. They're interpreting to me, and I'm judging it and reviewing it, and I'm trying to spin it back out. But I need interpreters for the wisdom that these folks are sharing or are trying to tap into in, within their own communities. And so that's been a stress. We're in it right now. We're into our second year. We have 4 years of funding, and I'm feeling some pressure about this to try to start addressing. And each of those grants has an evaluator, so we have information coming in, but it's based on what we've asked for. So some of the richness isn't necessarily being captured.
I've been working with refugee communities for 18 years, and to be honest, I don't have much. I haven't used research very much, and that's partly because there isn't much. But if there was some, I would use it, one, to get some ideas that maybe work for somebody else that I haven't thought of, or two, to justify to a funder why I want to do something. Saying that it's
been a- and I think we take ourselves so seriously. It's like, I mean, I'm serious. It's like, it's like, who comes to see us? Parents whose children are in child protection that need to get, want to get their children back. People who are in crisis that have been on a 72-hour hold that have basically been told if you want to do something, you got to go to a therapist or a psychiatrist. Or there, we've got, I wrote down reward-based programming. Because a lot of times the way that I get folks is I go out and say, hey, I'll give you a card if you come and, you know, I can give you information. But as far as particularly in communities of color, I bet you get 0.5% of the communities of color that use our services all on their own because they want to. I mean, they don't. I mean, it's like this system has said, because you're not functioning the way that we want to by our standards, you need to go and talk to somebody. Now, of course, we think you should go to a culturally competent person or a person of your culture because that'll help you be like I want you to be, if that makes sense. I don't know too many people. I know the folks that I work with, and I'm not, we don't do direct service, but those that I give education, the reason that they come to my workshops is because they're having serious problems with their children or their family member, adult family member, and they want help. But, I mean, it's a crisis. It's not a, oh, you know, I've been depressed for 2 weeks, and I think I should go and talk to somebody. If you all have seen someone like that, I want to hear about it. Because that's not the way it works, I think. And so I think that's why what I'm saying, I think we take ourselves so seriously because the community is not asking for what we're giving.
Okay. Yeah.
And too many times there's not honesty because when you're a person of color, you already know, well, if I report this, I'm going to be in trouble.
Exactly.
And so you know how to just give enough information, maybe sometimes to get a minimal amount of help, but then the underlying stuff still comes up because, you know, well, I'm telling this to this person, how much can I, and someone mentioned that trust piece, how much can I trust them, because once this goes on record, they're going to look at me in a different way. You know, I know when I first moved up here, I had a daughter, what brought me up here, someone that I know very dearly, but anyway, that's a side story. I was very, always proving my worth, because I had a daughter who was severely impaired, and to the general community, it would have been like, oh, this is probably a drug baby or something of that. So I couldn't feel like I could trust a lot of people. She wasn't, but I was always on the defensive when I went to a doctor or whatever. They had already tested her from where I came, and she wasn't. When I came up here, there were 6 children who were Caucasian who all had the same condition that my daughter had. I found that out by just doing some research, and so I felt a little bit more relaxed. But too often, people of color or minority groups will not give the truthful answers because they know that that's going to be a stigma.
And of course, child rearing practices and all involved in this. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just have to say that I think that when you're talking about people not wanting help and coming because they are sent or because of some outside force, that you're maybe talking about parents and children. And I have a very different experience working with adults, and I would say 95% of them are coming because they see something they need changed, and they want that, and they are not forced to come. And in the few cases where they are, because child protection sent them or whatever, in the end, when that work is done, they choose to continue to work on themselves. So I have a very different experience.
Excuse me, where do you work?
La Familia Guidance Center.
Can we get you right in this circle here?
No.
Please. I love a job.
Said and sort of push back down a little bit. I'm going way back in my personal history when I was actually a therapist, believe it or not. And my primary clientele were 100% court ordered. And it was mostly adolescents that I was seeing. So not a one of them started out saying, "Oh, I'm so glad that you're my shrink." I want to respond to you, but I also want to go back to the research question, too. I was really good at forming relationships with those kids and with their families. And what I discovered was that none of them were happy with the way things were going. And maybe their goal was only to get out of trouble, but still there were certain things they had to do if they wanted to get out of trouble. And they didn't have the ability to even make those choices. They were sort of victims of their own behavior as much as everybody else was unhappy about it. And here's where the research part came in. I was trained well in how to form relationships with those kids. And I always wanted to believe that by itself was therapeutic. But you know what? Some of the kids that I was the closest to, a couple of them met and they called me. They were sharing a cell in the adult detention center. So even though I formed a great relationship with them, I didn't help them to change their behavior so that they could get their goal of staying out of trouble. And I think that's part of what brought us together as a group, is that we hear and we believe now that there are new things that we can add to our repertoire that are research-based that will help us to help families to achieve their own families' own goals. And we're not always so sure that they're tailored to the culture of our children and our families, but it's an area that I think we really want to learn more about and need to learn more about. I just want to add something to what you're saying. I know you're trying to get in here, Richard, but I just don't want to lose this point. I think that there's at least two kinds of research, though. There's research that's done by others and research that's done in the academy and you know, large-scale, you know, stuff, and everybody here knows what we're talking about. And then there's the research that we do every day with families and individuals. Every day, every case that we take, every, you know, class that we teach is a kind of research. And unfortunately, our system is not real good at capturing the second or the latter. It's good at doing the former. And sometimes the former kind of research shapes what questions get asked or don't get asked, or what kinds of issues get addressed or don't get addressed. And one of the things I'm hoping this group can do is help us to get to that second, to quantify and to refine and to mine that second kind of research, because I think it's just as important. I'm sorry.
Richard,
and then
me. All right. Well, to me, I think, just like you just said, we don't serve people only, we invest. A lot of people of color, when they work with their group, we don't have to go and read any book. We invest so much time finding out those details that are not in the book about the people we work with. And so, to sit down here and say, I'm going to use this research, I don't think I will do that, because I invest and I research every day, even though it's not validated by outsiders. The people I work with validate those investment time that I spend in finding out, does this person need employment, rather than sitting down and do talk therapy. So there are different things that we are really missing. We are missing the point, especially when we work with immigrants who work five jobs and three of them are on Sundays, and you wonder why they're not in the church. Mm-hmm. Because three of the five jobs is on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And so we invest, we know when those times are, and we do whatever it takes, especially for the immigrants I work with, because they are not 3 to 5 or 1 a.m. to 5 p.m. therapy sessions. It could be in their own house. It could be where they go to drink teas, because some of them don't drink coffee. So when we talk about research, we need to know what level and what type of research. We need to research by being involved and just sitting down and say, well, let's look at this quantitative. Well, this is qualitative, and we need to look at that in that manner.
Thank you. Go and then Jen.
Okay. I totally echo that. I'm a firm believer in qualitative research. I should back up and say I'm probably an anomaly in this group in that I'm not a provider. I'm a policy person, health policy and program coordinator, and I need research to help inform good, inclusive policy of multicultural communities, of limited English speakers. So I staff a bunch of committees through the city of Minneapolis, including the Urban Health Agenda Community Advisory Committee, and the Public Health Advisory Committee, and that's the type of knowledge that we need to mine. And so, you know, when we have these committee meetings, ever since summer 2006, I am taking really detailed notes, which is, I think, unconventional for the city of Minneapolis, because I know that knowledge is so rich. I mean, that, you know, and I'm not going to remember everything, and including the immigrant knowledge. I mean, we have representation from American Indian, African American, Latino, mostly Mexican, Vietnamese, and Hmong. And I know these people's lives are so stretched thin, and these are the only times that they can voice, you know, to policymakers and government institutions. So now we're starting to take baby steps. Like, we've applied for a Centers for Disease Control Prevention health specialist, and we've worked into the proposal that this person would look at all these notes that we've taken. You know, the qualitative, the practical knowledge, the applicable research, the community-based participatory research, the research where the community defines what the research questions are.
Yes. What an idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure what our role is back here, because a whole bunch of things pop into my head.
Okay. Well, here's the deal. If you've got a question for this group, throw it in here, because then you guys are going to take these seats, and you're going to talk next.
Perfect. So I have a question for the one of the things that I am aware of, trained in academia, is that most funders are looking for the one right way that's going to work for the most people. I mean, that's the way Western science is set up. What pill will cure hypertension in the bulk of people? What mental health intervention is going to address depression in the bulk of people? And it doesn't allow for individual variability and the valuing of that. And so my question to you is whether or not the research that you're funding right now, does that allow for an intervention not to be algorithm-based, but more about a process? And an example would be what Joe was talking about, that he knew from, or he suspected from his work, is that, you know, therapeutic alliance or patient-centered approach, we're really letting the client dictate what the needs are and allow that intervention to be whatever it needs to be. Can that, does that fit in your funding framework?
That was exactly what we were hoping for. And what happens is we put the RFP out, people apply. We had culturally specific panels. Steve was on one that reviewed who was going to get the grant, and then each grantee was to get an evaluator, which then, you know, my hope was we'd have one person that could have looked across cultures, and I couldn't pull that off. But all this work is going on, and we're getting feedback, but again, how do we interpret this? And the bottom line goal, people of color aren't accessing chemical dependence treatment at the rate that would be helpful, we think. And those who are often court-ordered. And so what's the outcome there? Or probation focused or whatever. And, you know, I think, who's using treatment and are they benefiting? What are the programs? And the programs in Minnesota are 12-step, which doesn't fit for our changing population. So we have several levels of change that could be entertained. And we're in a position to look at that. And we want to. But I'm feeling a lack of resources.
I've got a double-barrel question. You can hop into it, go wherever you want for our last 5 minutes here in this round. And that is, in what ways have you or would you like to work with university faculty and staff, and might I say students? Rosie has been very, very helpful in this process. And I, for one, feel students always need to be part of this. So in what ways have you or would you like to work with university faculty, staff, and students, and what would make it easier to work? That's one question. Okay, you can go with that. Or then the other side of that is, how can what you do inform university researchers and staff members? You've covered a little bit of that, but what benefits can the university get from your work? Okay, and so either way, you can hop into either side of that question.
Just to jump on the last part of your question real quickly, I think they'd have better relationships with communities of color if there was a better dialogue. And I think, well, I'll just leave it at that, because I think that there have been some recent projects that have blown up in part because there was no relationship.
Because we've been small all the time, and we've always taken advantage of the limited number of bilingual candidates, whether in psychology, social work, marriage and family, whatever the field, we've always tapped into whatever was available in students, but they were the introductory people for the faculty that were at least receptive to allow them to help us identify some topic or something without being hurt because of their grade or whatever. And that takes work. And we've been fortunate to have quite a few young people in psychology and other fields. They have helped us kind of move it along. It's like the truck chucking it along. I mean, and I think we've solidified some relationships with some faculty. But it takes work. It's not true for all of them. But, you know.
Okay, here, there.
I was just thinking about what we're really working with or trying to help is the mental health of the children. And when I went to the university, the ivory tower thing was there. And to really get out and see what the children need and to be with the children so we can get to know the children. And I was just thinking about how my son lives in a building at 32nd and Blaisdell, and he's got the basement apartment, and the rest of the building is all Latino people. And the little guys are just so, you know, these lovely children that are playing in their yard and don't have any play equipment or any toys to play with, and so they play with what they can find. And I just think, you know, these urban kids, no wonder a lot of these kids have mental health problems if they either have the TV or this tiny little patch of ground with nothing in it. And so I think we need these kids, these college kids, to get out there and help to build programs to reach out to these little invisible people. Invisible, I say, just because nobody's been out there. I know some professionals that say, well, I wouldn't go there. And I say, well, that's where my son lives. I go there every day, you know, to that area of town that's really kind of a very poverty-stricken area of town. But there are people from the suburbs that are afraid to go there. And to me, it's children, it's families, it's a beautiful place to be. And so they need to get there.
Dana, you were next.
I work in an advocacy organization. It's advocacy, education, and public policy. And I know one of the difficult parts in trying to work with research is to get them to, researchers at the U, is to get them to validate what we, the community, think is important. And I remember working with a researcher that happens to be in this room, actually. And her job was basically to translate what we wanted into the words that the university could understand so that we could get our needs met. That's a very difficult translation, and sometimes it's not real cool. I know what parents want for their kids, and unfortunately what parents want for their kids is not what the researchers are looking for, so there is this, you know, there's this gap, you know, when they talk about, I'm talking about mental health disparities. Well, the mental health disparities is the research isn't really doing the work on what the communities, not only communities of color, but poor communities. Poor communities are in just as bad shape as communities of color because they're marginalized, they can't articulate right, or their lifestyle is dangerous or whatever. And so, again, it's like, I want the university to validate what parents are saying are problematic and need research, as opposed to what they have defined because of their clinical work, what is important.
Thank you. I was going to say a couple things. One, I think, you know, for being an agency that takes a lot of interns, I'd like to have more of a link between clinical practice and theories of what they learn in academics, and because I feel like we have a lot of the interns who are representative of different cultures and communities, and they come feeling really incompetent of, you know, like, how do you disengage with families? I mean, this is what I learned in theory. How do I practically roll it out? You know, and I think those are some of the things that make them feel like they're not as competent in a community, and we need more of those providers for us. So more of a link between, you know, what is expected for clinical work versus what is theories and basic knowledge that they need. And then I think also, you know, with the faculty is, you know, bridging more of that connection so that our families also understand what is the importance of research. Because I think many of them are afraid to really truthfully say, this is what I'm struggling with. And because they don't understand really what is this data being used for. So how honest can I be? With that, and without knowing that there isn't repercussion for me after the fact. And I think that we are missing out on, like, very basic things as, you know, what is just engagement? You know, what is trust in a relationship? Because they're not going to out me out for saying, she didn't do a good job of that, because I don't know what, you know, what kind of impact that will have. And I think part of that is building more of a relationship with community agencies who serve the different population. And we all know that our communities are very based upon trust. If I trust you and you say you can participate in this and be honest, that, you know, you get more accurate data.
Not exactly sure what I would want as far as the relationship between you and the community agency. But it's somewhere in this mortgage board of having a dialogue. I also supervise students, graduate students, in internships. And it also goes back to what Bill said. Some of, and I graduated from U here as well, with MSW. And what I learned was really snippets of what I was going to need to use in my practice. I think what I did, as well as many other students and professionals who come out of the school, you're reacting. You know, you're trying to figure out where you are. And it kind of also reminds me, if, you know, if you use an analogy of parenting, when you're a first-time parent, or maybe a second-time parent, you're kind of reacting. You're putting out flames, and you're you know, responding. And then the more experience you have, you know, the more you can go with the ebb and flows, and you can flow with parenting. You're not as reacting. You have some expertise, some wisdom and actual research behind it, be it what you've read or versus your own experience and provide your own research. And that's how I view the work that we do, the actual practice, whether it's clinical or a service provider. I work in adoptions now, and I've been working also on the clinical piece. But that's kind of that expertise, incorporating the research with the actual practice. But even when you are educated and you can take those snippets of what you learned, it still doesn't prepare you for that comfortable, you know, notion to kind of ebb and flow. That's where I'd like to have that network, that link with the U, because you have to allow folks to get to that point. But how can you prepare them for it so that it's not so, I have to learn it on my own? You know, and I know some of the Center of Excellence trainings are really good with providing you with some of that research and what folks have found most useful, or dialogue such as this, but this is more of a, we've been out there in the field for a while. So those newcomers don't have this opportunity to have, you know, to hear the wealth of knowledge. But that's what I'm thinking of as far as what could the U provide for us.
Well, I think if what the goal is to improve the services of all kinds to people of color, that the most important thing that the university can do is to train people of color in the disciplines. And I would venture to say that that's probably not happening at the volume that it needs to happen, because I think that that's where the services get done. That's where the interpretation gets made from the theory that you learn in the classroom to the practicality of working with the client. And it's that person who comes from the background of the client that can make that interpretation and can make that transition. So to me, the single most important thing that the university can do is to train more people of color and to do training grants that research how you do that best in the largest numbers and in the better quality. And to stop focusing on the provision of service, but on what their business is, which is to train people, to educate people in the mental health disciplines.
And last but certainly not least,
I think that the University of Minnesota is such a wealth of knowledge and research and a lot of good people in the national level are represented here. But there is that dichotomy in which the work that we do in community sometimes does not necessarily, even though you are a graduate from the University of Minnesota, there is a portion of your work that you have to go it alone in order to know that, in order for me to serve a family of this culture, what I have learned at the University of Minnesota, I have to combine with what I bring in my own heritage. And we need to value that in terms of the positivist approach, in which you need the evidence and you need to prove by that, but also what is it that communities have had over the centuries and over generations that can be brought on a par, because currently we're not quite there yet. And I think just valuing such discussions, such as this dialogue, and also to expand and shed light on this, that this is not a unique event, but one that generates replication. We desperately need this, and I agree with you. We need more professionals out there.
As you can see, once they got warmed up, we could go on for quite a while here. Some very interesting ways. Thank you so much, group. Before you leave, two things. You're going to leave your chairs here. The folks out there are going to come in, and we'll add if we need to. So we're just going to swap places, all right? So let's give this group a hand. Thank you very much.
You've just heard from the Cultural Providers Network. Next up in the fishbowl are University of Minnesota members who will now introduce themselves and discuss their work as Vivian Jenkins-Nelson facilitates.
Let us whip around. Give me your name. Wow, what you doing? Make these links.
Michael Logan, Program Coordinator for the Medical Schools Program of Health Disparities Research and Program Manager for Center for Health Equity at School.
I'm Joanne Patterson. I'm the Director of the Office of Community Engagement for Health in the Clinical and Translational Science Institute in the Academic Health Center.
Priscilla Gibson, Faculty, School of Social Work. I do research on African American grandmothers who are taking care of Korean children. at this point. I'm looking at school success in ICO school district and what grandmothers know about suspensions and how they can mitigate them.
Michael Goh, educational psychology. I also coordinate the counseling and student personnel psychology program. And as Vivian mentioned, I was feeling sort of bicultural earlier, but I feel very privileged to be part of the Cultural Providers Network and co-owning the research that we're doing to try and discover evidence in their practices.
My name is Van Moore.
Speak up.
My name is Van Moore. I'm in private practice.
My name is Patty Shannon, and I am a brand new assistant professor in the School of Social Work, and kind of a weird person to be in this group because I have just spent 10 years as a psychologist and community activist trainer at the Center for Victims of Torture, and so I still have a practice with torture survivors, and I came into academia partly to help bridge this gap, because out of the community work that we've been doing, the mental health needs of refugees, trauma, torture survivors became, you know, a huge issue, and working with, trying to identify them in the community has been a huge issue. So my colleague and I, Liz was kind enough to join me in working in collaboration with the state refugee health coordinator to try and develop culturally grounded mental health screening tools and approaches for adults and hopefully families. And that's what we're working on together, along with systemic community-based interventions that will work to help people with refugee trauma.
Hi, I'm Liz Wheeling. I'm faculty in family social science. I'm a family therapist. And I have no boundaries. I want to do everything somehow. But I think because of the complexity of the issues that we've been talking about here this morning, I have a passion in so many different areas, and a lot of it is really sort of bridging this intersect between micro and macro level work and trying to develop and collaborate with people towards developing work that can be sustainable in terms of change. So addressing mental health disparities, and particular area of interest is psychological trauma, particularly with populations exposed to organized violence and war. In the U.S., primarily my work has been with Latino populations, but a lot of my work is also international, and now increasingly with Patty, with the refugee community.
Okay, I'm going to be vicious now. Short.
Yes.
Okay. There you go. I promise you'll get a chance to talk.
I'm Chris Wing, and I'm a doctoral candidate in the Department of Speech, Language, Hearing Sciences. And what brought me back to school from a long clinical career with young at-risk children as a speech pathologist is finding out more about how the social-emotional mental health interfaces with their language and other forms of development. We treat them separately, and when you work with kids, they just bring it all to you. So that's my interest.
Meanwhile, and I'm in private practice.
Hi, I'm Mike Bloomquist. I work in the Department of Psychiatry at the U here. I'm a child psychologist practitioner. I also work with Jerry and others at the U on a prevention science research team, where we've been developing and evaluating early intervention programs for kids.
I'm Jerry August. I'm a professor in the psychiatry department, interested in children's mental health. Very happy to say at this moment that part of a group, leader of a group, who have just received a very large grant from the federal government to do exactly what we're doing here, community participatory research, looking at health disparities and children's mental health in the inner city, looking at prevention, preventative mental health interventions.
Pinay Chan is my name. I'm a pediatric psychologist in the Department of Pediatrics.
My name is Steve Maxwell. I'm the director of field instruction at the School of Social Work at the University of Minnesota. And for 22 years before that, before 2006, I worked at Community University Healthcare Center with Southeast Asian Mental Health Program.
I'm Nimi Singh. I'm faculty in the Department of Pediatrics and specialized in adolescent health and medicine. And my area of focus is non-pharmacological approaches to mental health promotion and physical health.
I'm Sue Everson-Rose. I'm an associate professor in medicine and associate director of the Program in Health Disparities Research and part of the Center for Health Equity as well. I'm actually a social epidemiologist and psychophysiologist by training. My research is trying to understand from a population perspective how stress and psychological factors impact chronic disease risk.
Rich Lee, Department of Psychology, and my research is looking at culture-specific risk and protective factors in mental health and development of primarily Asian American and international adoptees.
Yeah, I'm Tom Scoville, a professor in the Counseling and Student Personnel Psychology Program, and I've also been a practitioner, so I've done both these for 30 years, so I've been in both these worlds for a long time, and I'm kind of aware of how different they are and how big a gulf there is. My research interests really are about practitioner burnout prevention, self-care, resiliency, and also master practitioners.
I'm Oliver Williams. I'm a professor of social work in the School of Social Work at the University of Minnesota. And I've been a practitioner in another life, and I'm a recovering Lutheran.
All the Lutherans will be meeting for lunch.
A Missouri Senate as well. And I run an institute on domestic violence in the African American community. And we have several projects funded by the Department of Justice and Health and Human Services.
I'm Yang Pham. I'm a doctoral candidate in speech and language hearing science. My research area is bilingual child language development, so I'm working with the school right now, following children who speak Vietnamese in the home and learn English at school, following both of their languages over time.
My name is Amanda Block. I am currently in the social work cohort at Metropolitan State University and doing my practicum at La Familia Guidance Center.
I'm Amelia Burgess. I'm a general pediatrician at Eastside Family Clinic in St. Paul. I started out with an interest in foster care particularly, but I've broadened to everybody who might ever be in foster care. And I think I see a week doesn't go by that I don't have a mother tell me that she's being beaten up at home. So that's the biggest problem that I see in my life.
Hi, I'm Donna McAlpine. By training, I'm a sociologist, and I'm on the faculty in the Division of Health Policy at the School of Public Health. And my research really, what I really care about is social factors that predict mental health and illness and treatment, quality of care, and outcomes for people with mental health.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, as you probably figured out, the questioning is going to go kind of similarly, all right, unless it takes us somewhere else. Okay. So, what I'd like to have you talk about to start with is how do you come to conclusions about what you know? How do you come to conclusions about what you know?
We never come to conclusions. We always say we need more research, right?
Okay. Others.
I think that's a pretty good answer.
I think we need to be skeptical of conclusions.
I'm sorry?
I'm skeptical of conclusions.
You're skeptical of conclusions? Okay. All right.
I think it's easier to come to conclusions about what we don't know.
Okay. All right. Easier to come to conclusions about what you don't know. Let's ask, okay, more volume, I think, because people are having problems hearing back here.
I think that's, this is a fishbowl song they throw. I don't think that's true. I think we do always come to conclusions. And we come to conclusions based on evidence from multiple perspectives that come to the same sort of general truth, or what we perceive to be truth. And the challenge is when there's one person who's willing to contest that. And then we start expanding to what is the next question to address it. But I think we always, as researchers, as academics, are coming to conclusions, and that's what we pound into our students, about how do you come to a conclusion. But then the real trick is really to be open-minded enough to ask a second question or a third question.
I have
So let me say about that. When you look at the literature and you see the research suggests, and so to me that says, this is what I found here, and there may be someone who disagrees with me. The other thing is I think about implications for practice, and that oftentimes when you read a journal article, you will see that, but then you will also see someone who may disagree with that, and then there's another argument about why you feel you would go in that direction. If I would come to conclusion from my research with African-American grandmothers, or the conclusion that I have come to with my research on African-American grandmothers, is that there needs to be more research, and it needs to be really sensitive and context sensitive, because there's so much that we need to know, and there's so much diversity. And I'm not just talking about race and why the caregiving situation occurs, but in terms of formal and informal, the informal that we don't know a lot about because lots of families are not in the system.
I come to a lot of wrong conclusions. Chloroforms.
All right.
In the past. But I find that being spent a lot of years at a university, the best way to make conclusions is cross-validating by my colleagues in different departments. Never surprises me if I have some ideas, I'll find somebody else who knows something about it. This is the richness of this university faculty.
I think part of it is, in some ways, it's an issue of paradigm. What do we make about the knowledge we think we have, and how do we hold it? Do we hold it as these ultimate truths or pieces of knowledge, or are they pieces of a bigger puzzle? And I think that's part of what we're speaking. I like to think that I can hold them with humility, and it's sort of a temporary base, always open to new possibilities.
To me, I come to hypotheses more than conclusions. It's probably an iterative process, and personally myself, I'm a practitioner and a researcher, so I try to use both to inform the other.
I'm going to move on here. So how do you choose the work that you or your students will do, and is there flexibility? How do you choose that?
I think on some levels it chooses you. You know, and we probably don't talk a lot about this in academics. I think we talk about it more out in the field clinically. But most people who are in this group are very mission-driven. They have a passion. They have a very emotional reason for doing what they're doing. But we don't talk about that a lot in academia. But I think the work needs to choose you on a level that isn't just intellectual, because then the emotional and the intellectual commitment feed each other, and being able to merge those and add the intellectual basis to your intuitive sense is the perfect blend, so that those two worlds are not either ors. And a lot of times I think we talk about them as though they are.
I would agree with that. I think it's the whole research is research phenomenon.
The research?
Yeah, research is research. That I know in my personal experience, you know, when I was young, when I was a teenager, I had an uncle who died suddenly of a heart attack, and he was in his 40s, and everybody had a lot of stress because he ran this business. And then as I was exposed to psychology, both in high school and in college, I had a tool to understand why he died. And it just, so the science came behind it, but it was this kind of personal interest, and then I was always kind of biologically and medically oriented, so I was able to combine the psychology and the medicine piece. So for me, it really has been that. And most people I meet fit with what Chris has said, that there's some kind of driving passion that gets them interested in their science, and they can kind of fulfill that passion, but in a very empirical way, because they're scientifically oriented.
I would agree with what Chris and Susan said, that is often where we start, but what happens is as we get acculturated in the process of the science that we choose, it heavily pushes us towards looking at old answers and old ways of thinking and old paradigms, and then it becomes very challenging to step out of that, even when you know, what Rich said was, you know, it's hard to hold both two places, one being building on wanting to answer the question that you really want to ask, and then being pulled back into, but that has to be grounded on old thinking. And I think that conflicts then with really being open-minded about what if there's something out there that is so outside of the paradigm. Can I ask that? And those graduate students who go there are punished.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the most important things, though, is for faculty to not be bought off by all the tremendous pressure and rewards, and to go for things that are really meaningful and important to them. And it's one of the really important things to do in your career, but it's really hard.
One of the frustrations, I think, is when your research interests have to take in consideration funding priorities by major sources. For example, we were interested in rural mental health and kept getting feedback from the agencies that this wasn't a priority at this particular point in time. You know, and this affects your ability to do that kind of research.
I want to echo what Jerry just said, that I think that for lots of academics, their work is very much driven by what's fundable, and the paradigms by which they study things are what's in the current vogue in terms of how you study certain things. And I think it is a huge piece of the problem in us not being able to address what's at issue here in terms of the community's perspective about what contributes to mental health of children, because there just hasn't been a groundswell of support from the big funders to look at things this way. And I'm sitting now, I'm retired, but I've in a short period of time, working in this Clinical Translational Science Institute, which really is calling for a different paradigm about how do you engage communities in doing research. But it still is sort of inching up there, and it's not fully there yet. And it's just hopeful, I think, that the whole notion of doing community-based participatory research, where we really do what I loved how you defined dialogue, which is talk to action. And action is a key piece of community-based participatory research. Anyway, I'm going too far, but I think the key thing about what drives so many academics is survival in the institution. It's about getting big grants, and what determines that is what you're studying and that you're doing it with a paradigm that's fundable, and then you publish lots of papers. Mm-hmm. And so I think you can all sit back there and criticize academe, but you know, we deal with our economy as well in terms of how we're going to survive. And even though it's nice to think we can do what we want, we really can't.
I see a lot of head nodding going on here in this circle.
Well, I just wanted to add to that, you know, because in my department, I'm one of 44 faculty, but I'm the only one who studies minority populations. So there's the added pressure of I need to protect myself and educate my colleagues so that I can get, you know, my merit pay and my promotions. And I mean, because if I say I'm doing community-based participatory research and I'm going to start by doing 2 years of qualitative work, you know, that's like kicking myself and, exactly, back in my office and just leaving academia. So.
Interesting. Okay, come on out there. You don't have to put your hand up.
I completely agree with that. I know when I was an assistant professor and I told people senior to me that I was going to do community-based research. I heard over and over again, it's just part of my research. I do, you know, the locally quantitative in my office research too, but I was told over and over again that that was just a ridiculous thing to do as an assistant professor, and that if because it takes so much more time, it's so process-oriented as opposed to product-oriented. And, you know, after 6 years, you go up for tenure, and if you don't have enough papers, you get kicked out of your job that you've spent all these years trying to get it to get. So there are real pressures not to, you know, it's fine to have the community as like meet with them once a year and have them advise you, but to really do community-based research, there's, at least in this, my division, there was no incentive to do it. Like it was.
You know, for me, your original question was how do we come to conclusions? And for me, you know, and all these things that have been said go into the challenges of being able to do that. But for me, one of the things is that I want to study successes as much as I want to study failure.
and I don't think we're encouraged to study success. So when we were having conversations about in the other group, one of the things that I wanted to know was, do practitioners go to places that people in the community define as helpful, and that they're likely to go to seek help? But sometimes what I try to do is we've created 13 different films, videos, where we've asked people in the community about their reality. And that helps me in terms of reaching some conclusions. That being said, when we talk about surviving, you know, I also have to write academic papers. And so one thing is validated, and the other thing, despite how much effort it is, despite the fact that you may win international awards for what you do, may not get validated in the same way. So asking people, I think, and also knowing that there's a gap between going back to the histories of what, you know, we're supposed to know, and comparing that to what people tell you. And there's a book called Racism in Psychiatry. I don't know how many people have read that. I don't know if it's still in print. But it talks about the knowing and how sometimes we do, I think, value people who are gods in our work, and how that may be very, very different than what the communities tell us, because we trust the gods rather than other stories and realities that people are connected with.
I was going to say that it was not very clear to me the things I've been doing is because I'm interested in it, or because I'm doing so long I learned to be interested in it. And looking at Tom, you remind me, at university, we have a lot, especially in the medical school, there are expectations for us in our clinical practices. But we're also allowed to explore, keep some so-called pet projects. One was years ago, the single father project. Tom and I got connected. And we, that was Amos Diner, and we did it for almost 15 years. We meet with a lot of cool people every Tuesday night. You do it on your own, you're interested. It wasn't any financial success, but so we were able to have that freedom to do it. Most of them, I just have to do it and I learn to like it.
That's interesting. Do it and learn to like it.
Okay.
Are you looking at me?
I'm looking at you.
Okay.
Time to get in here.
Okay. You know, this conversation is easy to have post-tenure. But you cannot help, and I'm quite a spiritual person, you cannot help but be existential about things. And Tom was on the panel that worked on my tenure review. And because I think I did a lot of things that Rich recommends you don't do. I did quite a lot of qualitative research. But it became a balance of showing that you're listening to feedback. Do this, don't do that, publish here, don't publish there. But I know at some point I had to make a decision that if I did not get tenure, I wanted to not get tenure doing something I was passionate about.
Okay.
You know, there was a possibility that I would do everything that everybody said and still not get tenure. I'd be miserable. So it was a risk, but it was meaningful and it happened.
Anybody out here got a question? Yes, sir.
I did have a question for all of you. And just following up the idea of a conclusion, whenever you conclude your research, what makes you feel good about it? And I am talking about my wife is a researcher here at the University of Minnesota. I am a researcher, but I am community-based research. I mean, it's a different approach. But my wife feels very satisfied when she sees in PubMed several
quotations on her work. And I asked her, those that work for the community, is helping the community, is it helping any group in particular? And her answer is, well, in the long term, perhaps, not now. So from your perspective, what might be that thing that makes you feel good out of your research results at a point in which you are going to see something there out of, I mean, that it's going to be useful, not only for you to keep your points for promotion or your tenure or any other kind of ways of personal satisfaction, but beyond that point?
I went to a conference 2 weeks ago, and the theme of the conference was moving evidence-based programs from science to practice. And it was a very striking fact. It says it takes 17 years for an original scientific finding to really become sustained in practice. And that was alarming to suggest that the work you're doing on may not make a difference in the world for 17 years. So as a researcher, you have to search for and build smaller goals about how you're going to make this meaningful. And to me, it's always been going out and meeting people and giving presentations and trying to affect the lives of smaller groups of people. Because if it's going to take 17 years, you know, we're not going to live long enough sometimes to see that now.
You're looking at me.
No.
I don't have 17 years expected. But it was very interesting. I want to answer to this. You know, your wife was right. In 1997, 1999, in those years, I wrote 4 papers on one topic. I never knew what happened. It was done. It's a publish or perish. I had a number on my curriculum. That was it. Last month, I was preparing a topic seminar for our interns and fellows. On the same topic, I decided to do some literature search. It was very satisfying that I see, even now, those papers are still being cited. So that was something quite a few years. So sometimes does that happen?
Sometimes it does happen that way. I'm going to ask you now to think about what ways have you, or would you like to, work with therapists and providers of color or other community groups? So what ways have you, or would you like to, work with folks that are sitting around in this room? And I wanted to say just parenthetically that it also depends on a lot of what happens in the academic world. From my point of view, depends on whether or not you've got an agent. That's another story. Okay, for what you write. Okay, moving right along. So, how would you like to or have worked with therapists of color, communities of color?
You know, I went to one of these types of workshops, and what I heard from there, I still remember now, is that when you work with a community, and the community trusts you enough to work with them, the community has to open up, and that if a researcher comes in and takes the data, runs out, there's a wound that's kind of left, because you're open, and then you're not, you know, there's no closure, there's no, so I really have thought about that in working with a school that has bilingual education in Vietnamese and English, and maybe my work probably may not have a lot of impact, I get in terms of, you know, longevity, but just for myself, thinking, did I inform the teachers enough of what I'm doing and how I'm doing it through presentations? Do I have individual parent letters coming home telling the parents how the children did on the test that we gave them? And does the school know? Is there, does the larger Vietnamese community know about the research that's been done at this school, so that at least the mark that I leave behind is not damaging, and as well as in some way resolved. I mean, for me, academically, it would probably be resolved in a dissertation and publication, but for the community, I still want it to be resolved in the school website posting and disseminating information and teacher and parent meetings, so that at least the people that I've studied and my participants have know what's going on, and maybe people will find it interesting on you know, just learning about child language. So I guess
try not to leave a negative effect, and then if in some small way, moving it a step forward along with you know, the academic moving.
And you go along with what you said to support what you said. There's some research projects that are going on. There's a person that's a practitioner that made the comment that she didn't want the research to be like drive-by research.
Drive-by or drop-in?
And then and some of the information that's on the university's website about community-based research is really good principles for being able to engage communities and what's the benefit to the community. And making sure that they get something out of it, but that there's a relationship. It also means that you stay. You know, that you help to find answers. Some people do incremental pieces of work, find out something that may or may not be true, because it evolves, like Priscilla said. If you're smart, you realize it evolves. And there's no ultimate truth. But if you're going to be there, help people find answers that are going to end up making a difference in their work. And so I don't. So developing, and there's some good examples too. Pillsbury community, I think, has done some really interesting work in terms of developing a relationship between researchers and practitioners where they're moving together in terms of doing so. That's what I'd like to see.
Jump in.
I'd like to answer your question in two parts. I got very interested in global health issues for various reasons, opportunities that I had earlier in my career. And more recently, though, I have come to know at least one woman very well from the Somali community in the Twin Cities, and have worked with her on some different initiatives based on the work that she was doing with Somali immigrant women who were parenting children that were not their own, women that were very depressed, seeing that it was having a major impact on their ability to effectively parent their children, putting their children at risk for a host of different kinds of problems. And so she, on her own, had basically started an initiative working with these women and indirectly working with their children. And it was such a compelling effort on her part that she was having requests all over the Twin Cities to essentially train other people to do what she was doing. And so I learned from her a lot of things, and I thought that I brought some of my own research evaluation skills to the table, and we've worked on trying to get something funded to actually replicate her work and train other Somali women to do what she's doing. And we're still working on that, along with some other initiatives that involve some of the people in this room, that involve some of the schools here in the Twin Cities. So it was serendipitous that I came to know this woman, and we were able to work together, and it's been really important to me. Now, in the role that I'm in my post-retirement, is helping to get this Office of Community Engagement for Health going. And it addresses the issue that Jerry brought up about this recognition that it's 17 years from basic science laboratory research till it ever gets out there to really affecting the population. And that has come to be recognized nationally as unacceptable. A council of advisors, public advisors to the National Institutes of Health director, was very instrumental in helping to initiate this Clinical Translational Science Award that's happening around the country, which is essentially designed to close that gap. Part of that involves significant community engagement. That one of the problems in this long, that it takes so long, is that we haven't been paying enough attention to the issues that matter to communities and engaging them more effectively in how the research is conducted and how it's disseminated. And so there's money, and that's the sort of the thing I wanted to leave. There's some pilot money coming through this office and also through the office that Michael's working with, the Program in Health Disparities Research, that is specifically targeted at creating partnerships between academic-type trained researchers and community people who have a compelling question that they want to address. And I think that potentially bodes well for the future, because if we can support some of this kind of work, and it's very relevant to, I think, what Donna was saying too, that too many university researchers are discouraged from doing this kind of work because it takes too long, and don't do it until after your tenure, and then after your tenure, you're not going to be bothered with these little dinky pots of money. So we've got a lot of barriers to confront as we try to move this agenda forward, but I think it's the hopeful part in terms of how to work with community populations.
Yes, ma'am.
I want to say something about the little pots of money and maybe something challenging about partnership, because obviously in our project we work very closely with refugee communities and in a very sustained way, and you have to constantly be out there. You have to constantly be partnering and looking for sustained change, and that's essential to the work. It's almost a given. But I wanted to say something controversial a little bit about money, and that's that what we're trying, you know, to be in the community and make change takes money. And what we're trying to do with this project, and I think is a challenging idea for people to think about, is actually partnering and sharing the money. And the reason I think this is important is because it creates power sharing at the table a little bit. So you might start out your project with foundation funding, but the communities you partner with and the organizations you partner with need that money to do the work as well. In particular, cultural leaders need that money. And to even be at the table and be, you know, present and giving you energy and to support their organizations. And then, you know, one model we're thinking about is not only trying to pay the leaders that are working with us now, but if you can use that research to leverage larger pots of money, maybe like the ones you're talking about, but more academic pots of money, NIH money and things like that, there is the possibility that you can then share the leverage you have towards academic funding also with the community-based organizations that you're working with that will help sustain them towards developing sustainable effective practices. And that's it's challenging, but I think if you don't share your money, there's too much the temptation to do what you're talking about, which is take your data and run, because the whole system is set up that way. So it's something we're thinking about and trying to be fair about, and I'm not saying we have a lot of money, but just wanted to add that thought.
Thank you. Michael, where are you going to go? And then if you have a question.
It is the figurative getting out of your ivory tower, the literal getting out of your office. I was in happenstance and serendipity that I met David and Catherine McGraw-Shutman at the recommendation of one of my students who heard about my interest and said, you've got to meet Catherine. When I met, and when you are out in the community, it's and you hear that theory isn't bridging practice, science is not, that cannot be okay. That what you teach is not applicable, that cannot feel right. And when I share passionately with the McGraw-Shutman's my model of cultural competence, and they go, that's it. You know, it makes you want to be relevant, want to do something that is more relevant and more creative. When Tom says, you've got to meet Joel Hadley, okay, let's go meet Joel Hadley. And he introduces me to Ken Martinez, that workshop. So it's these networks that make you a better researcher.
Let me just do this and then go there.
I do small qualitative studies, and I am cheap. And I've done quantitative studies, but I have found that in capturing the voices of African-American grandmothers, a group who basically is silent, especially a group who is not in the child welfare system, grandmothers tell me their stories, or people allow me to recruit in an agency for a couple of reasons. One is I present myself and I talk about my passion for the work, and I bring my publications, and I might do a presentation for the staff. So I'm telling them why I'm doing it and what I hope to get, and that's the attention from policymakers. Now, we all know that small qualitative studies, I can't make generalizations. So this conclusion stuff goes out of the window. I'm talking about 25 grandmothers, sometimes 18 grandmothers, but these are people who are having an experience that's normally not out there in the literature. The other thing is kind of forming a relationship and talking about what these grandmothers have said. and going back, usually in a focus group format, and reporting that and asking for feedback on that. I am at the University of Minnesota. I have been at other universities. And you know, you talk about speaking your truth. My truth is, I don't feel like I'm in the eye of your child, even though I may be. And sometimes I've been in with African-American grandmothers who, when I say, I'm at the University of Denver, I'm at the University of Minnesota, honey, how are you doing? How are they treating you over there? And so it's that part of like a welcoming that I sometimes, not all the time, but I sometimes get, and part of it I think is my style, and part of my, and I think of it as a mission. And my mission is to explain research and to explain it in a way that I'm hoping people will understand. And I talk about being nosy. And I use my mom a lot when I'm talking about being nosy. And I also talk about confidentiality. And it's so interesting how African-American grandmothers, regardless of their educational level, will talk about making sense and being sensible and having sense. And they know about the Tuskegee study. And they want to know that I'm not doing the Tuskegee study. And I go, I'm not a medical, yeah, but anyway. And so it's those little things about engaging that I continue to learn. I may never make professor at my age, and that needs to be okay for me. Because I know there's some things that, you know, as I grow older, I've just decided to do that may not get me where I thought I would get.
I think I want to touch on three things that I've heard around here. And I'll start with just the one thing that starts it all. It's the politics of whatever we're talking about. Cultural disparities in whatever field, whether it's education, mental health, you know, we're talking that like a big priority. Yet, we want to confuse it by talking and categorizing people, refugees versus immigrant versus long-term. You know, it's gente, it's people. It's the changes that you need to start talking how to address it. The politics is by getting you confused and you trouble like this way, you fight each other for the little dollars that are available. That's one big piece. The second piece of the politics, every university, every department in the university has to fight politics about what's priority to survive in the department, and therefore sets you up to do that. The thing about all the professors I would love to have is not to tell me I'm a researcher on that. No, soy Robert Fabiño, give me your name, give me what your interest, your passion, because just like those grandmas tell you, African-American grandmas tell you about that, that would be true for Latino grandmas. I'm not Don Roberto is what it is. I'm not the counselor, the therapist. I'm Don Roberto once they get to know me. But I don't say I'm your therapist. I'm your therapist and I'm going to hear the help. No. Roberto Aviña, ¿cómo le ayudo? Roberto, how can I help you? Now I'm trying to engage that. And I'm saying that 17 years to get, that's generations. I remember. And people keep coming in new. So you forgot a whole bunch of generation, and new generations coming up, change some people. And you're still going to be 20 years behind. So it never changes. So the whole thing for us, not only the communities, we love to participate with every university because we got a wealth of universities here in Minnesota. Unfortunately, we have been misused. When they say we, the Latinada, we're not dumb. Just like the gente read, listen to the paper, listen to the radio. They did a research on domestic abuse. Somebody mentioned, my clinic sees a lot of women who are being abused. Oh, we see it too, both physically and sexually and other things, but we don't tie all the folks together. One of the things that La Familia has learned, that I have learned, I can have five Mexicanos. Somebody said that in the Hennepin County, the majority of the Latinada is Mexicano. Yeah, we have always been the majority, but there have been some changes in the demographics within the Latinada, the Latinos. Once upon a time, it was Mexicanos, Puerto Ricans. not no more. Mexicanos, Central Americans. It's a whole bunch of people together. We have to understand those changes. So I need to hear from all those changes because I don't know everything about Ecuador, Peru, Guatemala, but I better understand it if I'm going to help. And that's what I need the faculty to know with their passion. Because we're working together. When sure, we'll do, you know, beat your tamales and whatever, but, you know, you'll get your work done, write the paper, you'll be recognized.
Thank you.
My job is director of field instruction. A lot of my favorite part of my job is really getting to know people in the community agencies as I try to entice them into taking on interns. And we're very grateful for the services they provide in sort of helping the next generation along, and also always struggling to find ways to provide something of value to them. And I think it's a great untapped resource, that whole relationship between the student intern and the agency and the academy, that there are probably some dialogue that can happen, some conversations that can happen based on those relationships that could benefit everybody.
All right. Anybody just didn't get in here in this circle would like to hop in?
I'm a general pediatrician, so I'm not actually at the U and I'm not doing research, but when you ask what do I need from I need you in my office with me talking to parents and educating them about child development and helping when we do identify a problem. Because, you know, where I work, up until kids go to school, there are no other eyes on the kids in the family other than the pediatrician, but it's good when they come in. You know, it's a success when they come in and they know that they come to see me and they're doing something good for their kids and that's something to build on. And if I notice a problem and refer them, it doesn't work. It doesn't work a lot. So I need help in my clinic educating them about child development and then, if necessary, treating problems.
Can I just make an observation?
Yeah, sure.
We've been working with Pillsbury United Community Neighborhood Centers, Minneapolis Public Schools for about 10 years, and I just want to make the observation that we had a community-university partnership. And it was one of the most satisfying and one of the most frustrating experiences of my career. And the observation I have is that it really took about 3 or 4, maybe even 5 years for that partnership to develop, whether it was trust. They always were bringing in all the practical issues related to practice. We were always bringing in the research issues. There was always tension about trying to satisfy both sides of the equation. So I guess my message is that it takes time, it takes trust, and you just got to keep working at it.
All right. Thank you for this. Can we give them a hand?
Thank you for listening to the University Community Dialogue Podcast. We hope this broadcast has helped to bring you into this important conversation. If you wish to join future conversations or learn more about the Cultural Providers Network and the work they are doing, please visit our website at www.cmh.umn.edu. Thank you.